I'd like to thank my co-authors who worked on this particular paper. But I'm PI. I collected all the data myself. Nothing to disclose. So just a brief overview of what we're going to be going over today. I'll show you my purpose, some background, methods, findings, and discussion. So this is what I'm presenting you today is part of a much larger project that looked at self-identity and HIV risk amongst female sex workers in Tijuana. So unlike some of my co-presenters, I'm not specifically looking at those working in strip clubs or dances, but these are actually all women who provided sexual services. As it says in the slide, that it's looking at establishment-based sex workers. By that I mean is that even though they did all provide sexual services, they were not working on the street and just offering sexual services. They all worked in an establishment that had a quote-unquote cover. They were either a club, a dance club, a strip club, but all the women did self-identify as providing the services. And just so you can see at the bottom of the page that a version of this paper has been submitted for publication, so that, you know, hopefully will come out soon. Some background, just with, you know, because this is in Mexico and, you know, not everybody's aware of what are some of the gender and poverty issues in Mexico. So just to give you some measures of inequality, the gender inequality index, Mexico as a whole scores at 0.4448. If you're not familiar with this index, 0 represents complete inequality and a 1 represents 100% equality. So you can see Mexico is a little bit, just slightly towards the inequality half. And the Gini index, the first index is specifically on gender. The Gini index is looking at income distribution overall, and also, again, this is goes from 0 to 100, kind of like the other. So 100 implies perfect inequality, and 0 represents perfect equality, and again, we can see Mexico is more or less in the middle. So if you're not that familiar with Mexico, so Tijuana lies right at the, where's my pointer? Right at the border of San Diego and San Diego in the U.S. But this map shows different colors, and as I talk about my participants, even though the study took place in Tijuana, most of the participants were not originally from Tijuana, or some of them may have come as young kids and grown up there. But the graph, the colors on this graph represent, you know, the lighter gray and pink areas are quote unquote richer areas of Mexico, and the deep red are poorer areas of Mexico, which is where most of the participants came from. So the two main economic activities in Mexico is manufacturing and tourism. So this is just a picture of the border. The Tijuana-U.S. border is the busiest land border crossing in the world. And so I crossed it about every week, and it took hours to get back into the U.S. every time. In terms of gender-based violence, studies show that 67% of women have experienced some form of violence in Mexico, mostly in the hands of a husband or boyfriend. And of course, as we have seen in some of the other presentations, that women having economic dependence on men tends to exacerbate their exposure to violence. But violence in general, Tijuana, in addition to the interpersonal violence, you have issues of gang-related violence, the drug wars, which we know, you know, there's all kinds of stories in the news about how drug wars in Mexico has created violence, and it's also a big issue of human trafficking. So some of the physical effects of violence, specifically on women and on sex workers, you have, you know, obviously we have the physical effects, you know, we have broken arms, broken, you know, bruises, contusions, but also, you know, it can lead to rough sex or rape or coerced sex, which can lead to the spread of STIs and HIV. And also severe mental health impacts. So looking now more specifically at sex workers, and this goes for women in general, but so this picture sort of shows the three dimensions of violence, your physical, psychological, and sexual, and it can go anywhere from robbery to murder to rape. And it's just important when you're talking about sex workers that it's not just from clients, but it can be from clients, bosses, pimps, managers, we're specifically talking about here that violence perpetrated by males, but there, you know, we're talking about women on women, that could also be from other sex workers in sort of competition, also from police, and just, you know, people on the street who just think sex workers are the scum of the earth. So one of the things that this distinguishes this study from other studies is that a lot of studies on sex work and violence look at the effects of childhood abuse on women who are currently in the sex work industry, violence that they're currently experiencing. But, you know, this study does look at, you know, current violence, you know, whether, as I say, like in the hands of bosses and managers. But really, what's really important about this study is looking at what they experience as adults before entering sex work. No. So just to go very briefly, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail of methods because we've heard a lot about causative methods already in this panel, but yeah, it was a feminist grounded theory study, did it with interviews, and the University of California, Los Angeles, IRB approved this study. So here's just a brief chart that goes over my participants. So as you can see, most of them were not originally from Tijuana. They all spoke Spanish. This all data collection I'll go is that I mean it was done in Spanish. They ranged in work from less than 6 months to over 10 years. And even though I did say that this was based for establishment-based sex workers, as you can see, two of them say they're not currently establishment-based sex workers. One of them said that she recently had to get out because she was an alcoholic and couldn't continue to work in a bar. The other one said that she got so old that nobody else would hire her. But both of them reflected upon their experiences when they did work in an establishment. So, as I said, all interviews were conducted in Spanish. I conducted them all myself. Data collection was done between 2007 and 2009. They ranged in time between 40 minutes and 75 minutes. This just sort of briefly goes over the data collection. Just, you know, it was done simultaneously, all followed by the grounded theory method. Then I said, like, I'm not going to go over, obviously this is a huge project, so the findings that are related to intimate partner violence are in these categories. We have abusive family life, abusive violence with romantic partners, escaping violence, violence in Tijuana, and violence in the workplace. So these are the five domains that I'm going to review today. Oops, sorry. So in terms of abusive family life, there were quite a few who had experience, particularly in the hands of fathers or stepfathers, of abusive family life, and they sort of felt that it sort of impacted their way of managing life in general or violence in the future, beyond that point in their life. Just going to give you a warning that some of the quotes I'm going to be presenting may be a little intense, so I understand if you need to like cover your ears or your eyes or something, because some of them are pretty intense. So my father was always aggressive. My father beat me up on his whole life. That one, that's one way of putting it. Terrible, just terrible. So that's why I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. But now we're going to go through romantic partners. I think as we go through the quotes, just in the effort of time, I'm not going to read every single one because you can see them up there. But so most of them had an experience. They felt it was like a shared experience that they have experienced some sort of violence from a partner or romantic partner prior to coming to sex work. And most of them that did reported that it was from the man that was the father of their children.
I hear a lot of children.
I mean, the way they define marriage, you know, some of them, it's like, we might define marriage in terms of actually have a marriage certificate, but they considered them to be husbands or like husbands. Okay, so the next one is escaping violence. And so you'll see that in a much bigger, so just the three sub-domains within that. So we have no more tolerance, finding courage, and entering sex work. So some of this, you know, we heard in one of the previous presentations about how some of these experiences can affect entering sex work. So in terms of no more tolerance, they all said that they eventually found, really, they tried to put it all in a positive lens, how they found the strength to leave and to leave a violent situation, and that they no longer wanted to depend on somebody else for survival, economic survival. So then in terms of finding the courage, again, it's just reiterating some of the same themes that have been coming up. On the positive side, they were able to, you know, get the courage to leave, but at the same time, they felt that they were, on the negative side, that they were now left without certain resources that they need to be able to continue. In terms of entering sex work, a lot of them, you know, we saw this before, you know, if they were left economically, if they were economically dependent before, and now, you know, they don't have an education or they don't have other resources for financial support, so they felt really that sex work was one of their only options. Most of them did not see it as something negative. They said, like, I have my own job. I send out my own 2P. So in terms of violence in Tijuana, again, you can see this, they saw both the positive and the negative. So in Tijuana, they would, you know, stayed as a place to go because, you know, at the border, a lot more opportunity. But at the same time, they're like, oh, it's so much more violent, you know, not violence in the home with their partners, with their parents, but, you know, like a much more violent city. Most of them, they came from peaceful areas in Mexico. So they're sort of juggling with dealing with the positive and the negative, the promises and the perils of it. So just, you know, graphically depicting how they balance that. Violence in the workplace. Again, specifically in the workplace, we talk about johns and clients, pimps, bosses, managers. And I said I'm not going into it here, but there's also some cases of violence from other sex workers. This isn't particularly talking about male-female violence issues. Didn't include that. But they also talked about, a lot about how they developed their own resources to protect themselves, how they had to rely on their own wits, rely on their own strategies, how they developed buddy systems to partner up with other sex workers, and sometimes they would go to security, but they didn't feel that was ever a reliable source. So just sort of wrap up and sort of bring everything together. Four categories to sort of conclude this. So in terms of intimate partner violence or interpersonal violence and female sex workers, most of them had experiences with this, but it was a such strength for them to sort of escape those situations and found sex work as sort of like an empowering in that sense. Did a lot for self-preservation, whether it's about HIV or whether it's about violence, you know, making their own systems to protect themselves, but at the same time had issues of, you know, as you saw in some of the other presentations, you know, if you're offered more money to have sex without a condom or to have sex overall, like, so you said that you just have to put up with. So that's, you know, goes with HIV risk, you know, really comes down to you know, what are they willing to do for the money, especially if they have children, you know, to be able to feed their children. But this, in general, they say the more control they have over their life overall, the more that's connected with being able to manage HIV. So again, just, you know, again, I put this at the end in sort of different ways because really what was most important to them was being able to take a stand in their own life, whether it was financially, emotionally, physically, you know. So all of them who I talked to, none of them really said that sex work was degrading. A lot of them had dreams about being able to get out of it eventually, but it was really like, this is what I had to do to get myself to where I am today. So this image here sort of just brings it all together. As you can see, we have on this side things that happened prior to entering sex work, violence and romantic partners, and abusive family life, and how the process of moving into sex work was actually, and escaping violence was actually empowering. But once in sex work, it doesn't mean that they were completely void of violence in their life. They had violence in the workplace and violence in Tijuana primarily. Some continue to have violence with romantic partners, but a lot of them were just like, no way, I'm not going to put up with that. So within all of violence in all of their lives, they still had to deal with managing risk and self-preservation. A list of references. If anyone's interested, I can send those out.
Okay. So I guess we're ready to take questions.
I did not do any testing as part of my study, but I was working with what they call registered sex workers, which are those that have to get like a valid card. So if you test HIV positive, you will no longer be registered. So none of them who I talked to were currently positive for HIV.
Did you inquire as to a conversion to HIV positive or STI development? Did you do that?
No, I mean, nobody talked specifically about whether they had an STI. They were just like, oh, it's great that I can go to, I can get treatment for it. Because if you get an STI in Tijuana, like your card is temporarily invalidated, but something like chlamydia take a few antibiotics, it's not like HIV. So that's why there's no way that anyone had HIV, because they also currently had current valid registrations. But they're more concerned about like risk rather than the actual current status of infection.
I think it would be, if any of you have any experience with ICD-9 or what the upcoming ICD-10, the way that things are actually coded, makes a big difference in being able to retrospectively collect data and everything like that. So I would imagine that there's an easy code for violence, like a partner abuse, it's actually called. And I think that the overarching theme is that most women who are working as dancers do not seek access to medical care for their injuries, which is something I think that is an area for intervention. But for those who do, it would probably involve education and savviness of the doctor who's taking care of them, because the coding is so difficult. It's difficult to find, probably knee pain would be much easier to code for than, or knee injury, knee sprain, rather than fall from pole or something like that. There actually are very random ICD-9 codes that seem to be for things that you would never expect anyone to ever come in with, like fall from airplane propeller. That's a little bit of exaggeration, but not really. There's very random codes that I would have never imagined anyone I know would use them, but then there are not codes for things that you would think there should be. So I'm not sure what the ICD-10 will have in terms of being more specific to be able to collect data for injuries, but it's a good area of education for healthcare providers as well to be aware of this, to screen for injuries when someone comes in, as well as to code it correctly so that data can be used for further study. Great question.
It occurred to me when I was listening to comparing Portland, which I was unaware had such permissive laws on where clubs could be located, and then versus Baltimore and Providence. Mm-hmm. Would any of you like to comment on the regulation and the public perception about does this type of treatment in Portland maybe work better for other jurisdictions on cutting down the crime and peripheral violence associated with it? But of course, it occurs to me that the managers of clubs, a lot of it is due to who do they let in the door, but they really can't. There's less control they have over that than how do they usually then, of course, act.
I tried asking people their thoughts about, because in land use planning there is this big debate, should they all be concentrated or should you spread them out? And I asked people, what do you think, if they were all in the same place, is that good or bad? And most people didn't have too much to say about it. And then the community relations people that deal with the problems between all kinds of businesses and their neighbors, they said that in the case of bars, when they're near each other, it it causes problems, but they weren't sure about strip clubs. But what I found in Portland is that because you can't use the same kind of regulations that are used in other places, the way that problems get resolved is through community mediation. There's a city office that's called Neighborhood Involvement. And so if like my neighbor's strip club is playing the music until 3 a.m. and there's like trash in my yard, then they help facilitate a conversation and develop a non-binding good neighbor agreement. And it seems like in Portland it works better to create systems for resolving problems than it does to try and write a regulation that addresses a specific business type. I mean, as I explained, you can't do that, but it seems to work to find a way to fix a problem when you identify a problem instead of establish a template for what it's supposed to be. But that doesn't do anything to help with the health risks that the dancers face, really, because that's not, you know, the service is to resolve the neighbor's problem.
But the, you know, the management can, from, you know, from my understanding of reading the literature, and the management can have a, you know, an effect on the safety of the workplace environment, definitely. And the most, the thing that seems to stand out from the literature as being putting women at the most risk for violence is our lap dances and small closed rooms where the women can go in alone with the men, because therefore they're out of the watchful eye of security. And you know, management, it really varies a lot in terms of how close of an eye that they're going to keep and how much they're going to advocate for women and their safety. So, you know, if you can also look aside from the outside space of where the clubs are, the interior space, you know, and that has to do with, I can give you some sightings if you want, you know, types of stages that are used, and you know whether there's good hygiene, and if there's, are there wet floors, are there lots of dark alleys within the club, or does the management, are they able to keep an eye on everyone at all times? So there's a lot of like industrial engineering and planning that can also affect safety inside the club.
And there's also the business model issue, because if it's a club where the dancers make most of their money by selling lap dances and providing other services, and you're in competition with the other dancers, mm-hmm. there's less, you know, taking care of each other's concerns and keeping your eyes out. Whereas in Portland, because the cost of running a strip club are so low, that we have clubs that there's not any lap dances at all, and mm-hmm. it's only the tips that are put on the stage, and those are much more cooperative work environments. Because if the dancers work together to make it fun, then the customers give more money.
There's
so,
actually a dancer-owned club here in...
yeah, they're going out of business.
They are?
Yeah.
Unionized, that's so weird.
Yeah. We've got a question back there.
Here to you.
I would say that in terms of our recruitment, at least, the barriers were not, the dancers were very eager to participate, actually, and excited to participate. The main barriers that we faced were creating relationships with the gatekeepers, so club managers and doormen, really. So we had almost a 3-month process of just being on the block, creating those relationships, getting to know people, telling them what we were doing, telling them about our work, and sort of getting buy-in that way, and then we had access to the dancers. Because those people are most those are sort of the people on the block who are most invested in, you know, not if there's illegal activity, for example, not wanting to have their club shut down, or, you know, those types of things. So just telling them we're on their side and that this is really about, this is a health issue. But in terms of our dancers, at least, they were very excited to participate both inside, and we recruited them outside of the clubs. So we didn't really have a problem in that end.
I was actually going to pass because I actually got involved in this project after the recruitment process. What told me is that they had two research assistants who became very familiar, got to know, similar to what you said, the management of the club and established rapport with the management as well as the dancers. And then they did not have issues at all with people recruiting people, and dancers also seemed very eager to participate, as well as other employees of the club, which we looked at in our study.
I'm at the beginning of your talk, so I apologize if this is something that you already went over, but you mentioned the concept of safe social support. Can you talk a little bit more about what characterizes safe social support?
Basically, when it comes to this study, I actually have two studies running at the same time. One is talking to the advocates, the other one is talking to actually women who've experienced domestic violence. And coming from the African-American culture, that safe social support is one that has that emotional support, that very positive emotional support to you. But unfortunately, within the African-American culture, and I can go ahead and kind of speak to this, we tend to be very rough when it comes to advising each other and talking to one another. So it's a form of discipline. We're trying to hurry up and get the person out of the situation. But that discipline is something that's very emotionally destructive to a woman who finds herself in an abusive relationship. So I have done a number of studies with the victims themselves. And I would always ask the question, what do you think Black people in general think about women who are involved in abusive relationships? For the majority of those women, the word stupid was one of the first words that came out of their mouth. And I just found that amazing, qualitatively speaking. You see that word stupid. There are been a number of situations where mothers would call their child stupid and throw them out of the house for being in an abusive relationship. There was one situation, this is going to be a little graphic. Is everybody going to be okay with this? Where her sisters were sitting in the living room and the victim's husband comes in, pulverizes her in the middle of the living room, drags her out by her hair to the middle of the parking lot, and continues to beat her. Sisters are still sitting on the couch. She had to crawl into the house to call the ambulance for herself. And her sisters turned around and told her, well, that's what you get for staying with him. So it's that sort, and I'm not saying that all Black folks are like that, by the way. Let's just put that on the table. But in these particular circumstances, that emotional support, not there at all.
So if that's not there with the family, like as service providers, with the service providers, were they able to provide safer social support even though they weren't family members?
Yeah, absolutely. That safer social support came from that empathy and that understanding about what domestic violence is. So because they start off with understanding what it is, that empathy is already there. But then I'm sure you've got a lot of super people that don't know anything about domestic violence that are service providers that are equally as destructive as well. Yes, ma'am?
This is for all the researchers. Was there ever any time where you were concerned for your own safety when you were going into the interviews in your club?
I did like some key informant interviews before I started collecting my data to make sure what would be the right ways to go into the field and not be in danger. So I followed the advice of people who had just been around a lot longer to protect myself.
I have had a few situations where I don't work directly with sex workers, but I've interviewed women that were prostitutes. And there were two situations where one woman actually pulled a blade on me at one point in time, and the other one just got very aggressive. She stood up, and I triggered something in both of them. It wasn't directed towards me. Lesson learned on my part. I settled them down, but yeah, it can be dangerous at times.
You were kind of reacting in the same way they would with a partner or somebody else.
Actually, with one of the women, I accidentally went like this, and that's what triggered with the sound. She's the one that pulled the blade, and I went, sweetie, calm down. I'm glad I'm from Cleveland. That's all I have to say.
Now, I recognize that this hasn't been the focus of your work, but a number of comments here made me think of the actions of providers to both people who are in violent relationships as well as women who are injured or violated as part of their sex work. Did you hear any anecdotes or do you have any suggestions for providers about being more trauma-informed or respectful? Because the shame and stigma associated with some of that, whether it should be, I mean, no, that would be judgment, but clearly there are stigma associated with sex work and the violent relationship. Just curious if you came across anything or had any insights.
Well, I, I, not through the study, but it, you know, most of my time is spent being an intern, and so primary care and hospital work, and I have come across both the outpatient and inpatient setting, partner violence, that it's so prevalent. So definitely, I think, recommendations is the first thing, is really validation of someone's feelings, and for them to know that they're not going through this alone, that there's many people who are experiencing similar things, that it is normal and okay for them to be experiencing whatever feelings they are, and that, you know, that sets a stage for it being a safe place, you not being judgmental, and, you know, it provides some sort of solace to go on, and, you know, and then there's creating safety plans, providing resources with, you know, a variety of staff, social workers, and shelters, having a backup plan as needed, and then, you know, there's a lot to do specifically when, you know, you can have kind of a little checklist, but I think the first step, especially to what you're talking about, is validation.
Is that, it sounds like you're addressing the people in black relationships, what about those who are I'm just curious about
as part of what?
Sex work?
Yeah, provided reactions, I would think it would be potentially very, it could be anything. I was just curious what the reactions about
if you're working. Sure. I don't have any specific anecdotes that come to mind because I don't think I'm not aware of any of injuries that that I've treated that have been a result of sex work. However, you know, my practice is somewhat limited because the primary care office that I was working before, people couldn't really get sick visits very easily. So if an injury occurred, it usually didn't get seen right away at our clinic. But I think just providing a non-judgmental reaction and not being afraid to ask questions, you know, people are very, if you don't have training, you know, you think that by asking someone if they're feeling suicidal, you might be encouraging them, or if by asking someone, you know, direct questions about their work or what happened, you might be probing too much, but really people are usually very, very willing and ready and want to tell you about the details of what happened. So I think just being straightforward, honest, and compassionate and caring, obviously, you know, body language, not becoming all stiff and moving away from someone if they're disclosing something that you feel might be very sensitive for them, and leaning forward and just looking them in the eye and showing that you're a compassionate person that is here to listen to them and help them. And a lot of it is, you know, hearing about what's going on. They may very likely not be ready to leave a situation or change their job or profession, you know, based on an injury. But the first step to providing any good care is trust, you know, like you're alluding to. So it's usually what I do or try to, I hope.
Patient provider confidentiality is a lot very important in those cases.
Oh, of course, yeah, and that's a good point. Just letting someone know who's coming to you that everything is confidential. However, if it's a child involved, different story.
Like, yeah. I find that, like, you know, before even having a compassionate provider, it's like the women, they're like, oh, this is normal. Like, why should I tell anyone? Mm-hmm. I got beat up by John. I got, you know, whatever. Like, they just don't even see that, you know, what's the value in disclosing it. And some of them disclosed to me, like, I got horrible stories of kidnapping, of rape, but, you know, it was just like, you know, a client roughed me up. They're just like, part of the job.
That's actually a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because one thing I didn't mention when I was talking about how to respond to someone who's disclosing violence to you is not only do you validate, but you also show them that, you know, tell them that what happened is not okay. And that's a really good point, because I'm sure, you know, it becomes normalized.
Yeah.
Life, so. Phone call for us?
Precisely. I took the plans down. It's 2:00, so if you can please give a hand to my colleagues.